This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Thanks very much indeed. Mark Kermode is here. We're going to be talking movies. Let me just get this one out of the way. This is an email from Alex from Newport.
It's an inauspicious start. Let me just get this one out of the way.
No, it's just an interesting email. Okay, let me start with a really interesting email.
That's better.
From Alex.
Yeah.
Dear Witterers, I'm currently revising for my university finals and I'm thus in the process of trying to read all the things I should have been reading throughout the year. Mm-hmm. I suppose that makes me, what I'm doing, learning rather than revision, but never mind. Anyway, one of the pieces on my incredibly long list is an article by the Good Doctor entitled Horror on the Edge of Taste.
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering if Mark could give me a brief summary of the article so that I don't have to bother reading it, reducing my list but just by just a little. In return, I'm happy to use the word commodian in my exams coming up, thus contributing to your campaign to get it into the dictionary. So just to save him a bit of time.
I'll do it very quickly. It was written for the Index on Censorship, and basically the thesis of it is that in order for horror to work, it has inevitably to always go up to the boundary of what is acceptable and then slightly beyond. It is in the way that, the classic horror fiction is. It expresses the inexpressible. Consequently, horror will always be on the edge of taste and will always be a problem for the censors. Unfortunately, since I wrote that article, the BBFC is completely rewriting of the guidelines, which means that they're now the most sensible and horror-friendly people in the world, means that it's probably not true anymore. But it was to do with horror, in order to work, has to constantly challenge whatever is the boundary of the acceptable and has to be borderline obscene in the Greek meaning off stage. Obscene, off stage.
I've got that. All of which is a perfect cue for Neil Marshall, whose new movie comes out. It's called Doomsday. Stars Bob Hoskins and Malcolm McDowell. Hello, how are you?
I'm good.
Okay, following that, from what Mark has said, what is it that you're doing in this movie which pushes that envelope and is obscene in the classical Greek sense?
I'm just going to try and push the boundaries of violence and gore in a British action movie. So
a British action movie, is that how you're describing it?
Yes.
It's not a horror movie. It has horrific things in it, but it's not a horror movie.
How would you describe it?
I think that's absolutely right. It is an action movie. It is like, if you imagine a film like Mad Max and the Lost Tribe movies that we saw in the sort of 1970s and 1980s, you know, apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic society. If you imagine all of them rammed together in a blender with a soundtrack that includes Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Adam and the Ants.
Oh, yes.
Adam and the Ants, all these put together, and then dropped out of a building at an incredibly high speed. That's what it is, because, as you know, I mean, Neil directed before he made the movie The Descent, which is really claustrophobic, and I really loved it. In fact, Neil won a prestigious Kermode Award for that, the design award.
I did, thank you very much.
The evocation of those claustrophobic caves, which was in fact all done with, you know, polystyrene and glue for about threepence. What this is, okay, I've done that, now let's see whether I can make a full-on, absolutely, you know, no-holds-barred, adrenaline-pumping movie. And that's what it is.
So explain Doomsday, and we're in the UK and Scotland specifically.
Yeah.
For the start of the story.
In a nutshell. A flesh-eating killer virus breaks out in Scotland. The government, as a last-ditch resort, wall off. They rebuild Hadrian's Wall and isolate and quarantine the whole of Scotland and the north of England and leave everybody to die.
I suppose it's one way of getting the government out of their sort of Scottish problem at the moment, isn't it?
Do we call a referendum on whether or not to do that and leave them there?
But if everyone dies of a flesh-eating disease, then it's not going to be much of a referendum, is it, really?
Yeah, it's kind of devolution taken to the extreme.
Yeah.
Everyone doesn't die.
Right, so the wall goes up.
Yeah.
And then
this is the first 5 minutes of the film.
Yeah, okay.
Then we pick up the story 30 years later. The same virus reoccurs in London. A vastly overpopulated London, and the government reveals that they've actually found traces of survivors north of the wall, so they send in this team of specialists, soldiers, scientists, to go and try and find a cure.
Explain what this flesh-eating virus, what is it?
We call it the Reaper virus.
It's a non-specific science fiction flesh-eating virus. It really doesn't need to have much basis in science.
Okay,
it doesn't.
Just imagine Mark has got it now.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's going to happen to him?
It's weeping pustules, rotting flesh. You bleed from every orifice. Your internal organs liquidize.
Like, he's got the idea.
Your makeup people had a ball with this.
They did.
Okay, so then what happens? Right. So we're 30 years later.
Yeah. So then this team goes into Scotland to try and find these survivors, and what they encounter in Glasgow is this crazed, cannibalistic tribe living amongst the ruins.
With a strange fondness for Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Adam and the Ants, which is almost the scariest thing. It's like, it's not that they've survived this flesh-eating virus. It's not that they've been walled up for 30 years. It's the fact that their jukebox appears to be stuck at exactly the period when... Did you have big hair when you were younger? Did you have the big goth hair?
No, God, no.
Because everyone's also got the big, got, you know, the Mohican...
The works.
It's a sort of accepted movie trait that at the point that society collapses and the apocalypse strikes, the first thing that will happen is everyone will get a Mohican, because otherwise you won't be able to carry on.
So there's a touch of Escape from New York there.
Yeah, a touch of Escape from New York. There's a touch of John Carpenter in there, definitely. Yeah. You're a big John Carpenter fan.
Because everybody gets themselves, you know, super-powered cars.
What happened to John Carpenter? He was great, wasn't he? He makes rubbish.
Yeah, so. But even he thinks he makes rubbish now.
Does he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, John Carpenter once said to me, have you seen... insert name of movie here, and I said no, and he went, he didn't miss anything, and it was one of his.
He's too busy smoking cigarettes. That's what he likes to do most.
Right. Moving swiftly on.
That's not a great way of spending your life, is it? Really.
No. So, but he's making something new.
Do you think we can see John Carpenter's influence, the good John Carpenter stuff, in this film?
Oh yeah, it's writ clear all over. I mean, I kind of wore it on my sleeve going in that this was very much a tribute to those movies, all the Mad Maxes, the Escape from New Yorks, all that kind of stuff, even the Warriors. Just those great movies from the early 80s.
The Warriors, which is now a very overlooked film, but at the time was so controversial that it almost didn't get... Do you remember all the radio adverts about how it's caused rioting and, you know, we can't play it in your local cinema because if we do it, it'll be exactly the same as what happened when they first played Black Bull. Well, it was interesting because it had the same stigma to it that Black Bull Jungle did back in the 1950s. If we play this in cinemas...
It was on nationwide. They were up in arms about it because it was going to cause riots in cinemas.
Geraint on this email, Simon and Mark, I'd like to preempt... Mark's, I should have done this a couple of minutes ago. Yeah. Mark's negative, sniffy review of Doomsday by telling him that he's completely wrong. I saw the film last night and it was terrific. Cliched, silly nonsense, yes, but brilliantly directed by Neil Marshall. A cheetah-powered roller coaster ride full of thrills. He wants to get on the poster, doesn't he? A cheetah-powered roller coaster ride full of thrills, chills, and or spills. I don't even care if Mark hasn't seen the film yet. He's still wrong, even if he likes it. Wrong.
Well, I would like to say that. I mean, it's fantastic to preempt it. As anyone who's a regular listener will know, I'm a big fan of Neil's work. I mean, I was a great champion of The Descent. You know, we had the guys from Dog Soldiers on before. And I think the whole thing with the new movie is that the question is, can you sustain now, because basically it is sort of Frankensteinian creation. It's lots of bits of other movies. It's very, very knowingly referential, and that can go either way, because people can make knowingly referential movies and your heart just sinks. But I think what Neil's managed to do, and I think it's because he's a really good director, is to stick all that stuff together in a completely sort of absurdist parable and then throw it at the screen so hard that you're just literally run over by the movie and you come out going what was all that about? And you know, and I say that in a good way. I mean, there's one bit when it's they said, well, we're going to play a clip. There's a clip, there's a bit with Malcolm McDowell. They go off into another section. It's almost like they've wandered off either into Robin Hood or the set of that TV programme Raven. Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
Well,
it's
program.
Like Raven, but with great big boulders in. Anyway, here's a clip.
These walls around you, they were built to last, and so shall we. What we've built here from the ashes is pure blood, uninfected by the outside world. Until now.
Have you found the cure?
Huh. Ah, even now you still cling to hope, huh? If I were you, I would abandon any such thoughts.
There's always hope.
But there is no cure.
Get it?
There never was.
I sound like John Hurt there.
No.
Malcolm McDowell, so just explain what was happening there, Neil.
Well, Michael McDowell is kind of like the sort of Kurtz character that the team are trying to find throughout the movie.
That's Kurtz from Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, filmed as Apocalypse Now.
He was the doctor that was stranded behind the wall, and he was the guy who was trying to find a cure. So they think he's the answer to it. It may or may not be the case, but he's lost his mind and he's kind of become this kind of feudal lord in the future Scotland.
He's become Raven. That's why he's turned into only not Scottish.
Raven was a great programme.
No, I think it's still on, actually. Raven still is a great programme. Raven still is a fabulous programme. Yeah, I've got no problem with it at all. So what was Malcolm McDowell like to work with? Because I've never met him, but I'm a huge fan of his.
You should have come in when he was on the show a couple months ago.
I know. I wrote a piece for Sight and Sound back about how he's the greatest living British actor.
He's so down to earth. He just loves what he does. He loves making movies, so being on set to him is like the best place in the world. And he made my job so easy. I mean, he was only there for like a week when we were filming up in Scotland. And no, I just think he's awesome. I just think really, really great.
A lot of it filmed in South Africa.
Yeah, everything but 2 weeks. There's a segment in a castle that was all had to be done in Scotland, but everything else we shot down in South Africa in Cape Town.
So you've got Cape Town City Hall as the exterior of St Andrew's Hospital in Glasgow. It's an interesting juxtaposition of the two. Is it just cheaper to film in South Africa, is it?
It's about a third cheaper, yeah.
How many shots are there of Hare Krishna followers?
we got them in there.
And are they at the heart of darkness here in the movie? Are they the secret to unlock what's going on?
No, they failed to escape from Scotland before the wall goes up. I couldn't resist putting them in there. And they made me and the DOP like honorary Hare Krishnas at the end of the shoot. They had such a great time just coming in.
So they really are Hare Krishnas?
They really are Hare Krishnas in one scene at the very beginning of the movie. I don't know where this rumor came from, but they obviously found out that we put them in there.
But they survive, do they?
No.
Oh, they don't. No. I thought maybe they
very
had
few of, people survive.
Well, maybe they had. You know, maybe that's maybe the chanting and the singing. Maybe they, you know, it was a good protection against this flesh.
Yeah. No.
Virus.
That's not going to work. No. You need huge, great, big Gatling guns, and you need to be traveling very far. Can I? The other thing I want to say about this is that we've often had a discussion, you know, you and me, about horror and you know whether or not there's anything sort of innately wrong with people liking, you know, flesh ripping horror. The thing that I like about the movie is that it is full on meaty gore. But not in a way that when Simon said at the beginning, you know, it's a horror film. It's not a horror film. It's an action movie that is just incredibly. But there is, I think, sometimes a perception that those kind of movies must be repulsive. They must be horrible. And yet, the thing that you get out of a Doomsday is it's a rip roaring. You know, it's a ride, and it's not meant to depress or upset the audience.
No, it's never meant to be offensive. But I just took extreme action to the extreme. That I figured if someone's going to get hit by a tank, then I'm going to show what happens.
And there is there's this car with the cars running towards each other at apparently sort of 100 miles an hour whilst Frankie Goes to Hollywood are playing, you know, When Two Tribes Go to War.
Just figured that, you know, ever since I first heard that song, I thought that would be really cool for a car chase.
And is
movie.
It easy to do? Because you haven't done car chases before.
No, God.
I mean, you've done caves and people running around in woods.
It was a bit of a change. No, we had 3 weeks to shoot that car chase, so it was a blast from start to finish.
What are you going to work on next, Neil?
I'm writing another horror movie called Sacrilege, which is a Western horror movie. And I'm also working on a project called Drive with Universal.
One other mention. Clearly you've fallen out with Sean Pertwee big style because, you know, key part of Dog Soldiers. But boy, he goes in a bad way here, doesn't he?
He's starting to get a reputation for dying horribly in my films.
It's a lot of competition. See who can go in the worst possible way.
And Sean just wins every time.
But he's gonna be in the next one, is he?
I certainly
devise
hope so.
Something like splendid for him.
Can I say finally before we end with Neil? Just I think the thing that's important as well is The Descent was not seen by as many people as it ought to have been seen by. It was a peculiar thing. The Descent was a really, really terrific piece of work. I still actually think it's your best film. And if people haven't seen The Descent, they should get it on DVD because I watched it on DVD and I was amazed how well that
it
holds
up. Pretty
it
good.
Really does. It's a really
especially if you're watching in a dark room.
Absolutely. And it's all to do with the sort of the group dynamics. And I mean, unlike this, in which it's much more to do with everything moving at 100 miles an hour, it's to do with, you know, with much sort of smaller interaction. Because there's a good 45 minutes of The Descent in which it is literally just the group interaction before the stuff really hits the fan. And, you know, I think it's a really good example of just how well you can make a movie on a zero budget that is genuinely oppressive and terrifying and a terrific piece of work.
But for the moment, Neil's new movie is called Doomsday. Appreciate you coming in, Neil. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you. That's been great.
Good distribution. It's on everywhere.
It's out across the country today.
There are posters all over the place, but not on buses, crucially.
Don't put posters on buses. Although a few listeners have pointed out that the new Indiana Jones movie is being advertised on buses.
The new Indiana Jones movie is going to be advertised on the inside of your head.
Okay.
I mean, they're finding ways to put adverts for that everywhere.
Neil Marshall, thanks very much indeed. Box office top 10 this week at 10 Persepolis. Just last week I said Persepolis, and clearly that was just ridiculous.
No, Persepolis, I still like it very much. Good to see that it's been in the top 10 as 3 and Out hasn't been and hasn't troubled our top 10 as far as I believe. Despite the fact that it's about, you know, the oppression of women and difficult political regimes, it's bright and sparky and funny, and it's Marjane Satrapi's own story, and it's beautifully told in terms of the animation. My only reservation is I think probably that I would have preferred to have seen it in the original French language as I did in Cannes, but the dub is perfectly fine.
Jack on this says saw Persepolis this week.
Can't do it, can you?
A really interesting film, one of the most stylish I've seen for a while. Is it just me, or is there a fantastic nostalgia that makes watching hand-drawn animation so great in this age of CG perfection. Films like Persepolis are a treasure in these modern days, and I thank the good doctor once again for recommending it.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that in a way, the distinction between hand-drawn and computer is completely... I mean, it doesn't really exist anymore. If you look at, for example, the films of Miyazaki, which are famously hand-drawn, of course, they're hand-drawn but computer-animated. I mean, everything now uses computer-animated. It's a mixture, so the two things are coming together. I did believe for a while that, you know, that there was this kind of evil camp of 3D digimation. On the other hand, there was this great camp of, you know, 2D, you know, hand-drawn. But in fact, more and more they are coming together. But the thing about Persepolis is it's absolutely the style of the graphic novel source. They've just said, well, that's what the film should look like, and it does. And I agree, because I have seen enough 3D digimation movies now to really expect something more of them.
And Bags in Bristol went to see Persepolis last week, which I absolutely loved. But when I recommended it to a friend, they had reservations over whether the film was suitably cinematic enough that it needed to be in theatres as opposed to being shown on television. Remembering the good doctor's similar quibble over Stephen Frears' The Queen, could I therefore describe my friend's reservation as being commodian or even commode-like?
No, because when I say that The Queen is a TV movie, it's not just visually that it's a TV movie. It's that it is a TV movie. I mean, of course, it actually started life as a TV movie. It then turned into a film sort of by mistake. I mean, it was effectively the second half of that project that began with The Deal. I think Persepolis is cinematic. Cinematic doesn't just mean huge, wow, zap-bang vistas. It's a different and perhaps slightly indefinable quality.
Bags continues. Incidentally, since briefly mentioning on my blog your campaign to get commodian into the dictionary, it's received a record number of hits and several messages of consent. The people have spoken. Get the word officially recognised. Happy-go-lucky at 9.
Well, you know, as you and I have discussed at great length, whether or not you like the film and whether or not you like the central character may be two different things. People have taken the new Mike Leigh film to their heart. I'm stuck slightly with dealing with its boundless optimism. I do think that the character of Poppy, once you discover that she's a teacher and you find you come to like her. I don't think I ever do, as Mike Leigh says you need to love her. I just think I can't get beyond the smiley, happy persona.
Fool's Gold at 8, and this email from Nida says, Simon, I'm still curious as to whether the bad doctor, but in a good way, has done his duty and gone to see Fool's Gold yet. The film's almost certainly rubbish, but I just want to ask whether the two leads, Matthew Mahogany and Kate Hatstand, lived up to their names. I know it's childish, but go on, indulge me.
I didn't go. I still haven't. I can't, you know, I can't bring myself, because every time I walk past that poster in Leicester Square of, what did she call it? Matthew Mahogany
and Kate Hatstand.
Joining IKEA Nightly. I'm really, Matthew Mahogany, that's just brilliant. And for that alone, I thank you anyway. So I still haven't, because it's him with his arm around her, and I just think I'm just going to vomit before I even get in. Who knows? It may be a masterpiece. I haven't seen it yet. I'm not going to review it without having seen it.
In Bruges at 7.
Which I like. It is very scabrous. People have gone to see it, have sent in emails saying, you know, how much they've enjoyed it. It is clearly a movie that goes out of its way to be verbally obnoxious. It's the best thing Colin Farrell's done in a long time. It doesn't quite have the stripped down brilliance of his short film, Six Shooter. But it is edgy and funny. And I do think Colin Farrell is very good in it.
21 at 6.
Yeah, you know, which is flashy. And I don't know what it is with the whole, you know, gambling thing. You don't gamble, do you?
Pardon?
You don't gamble, do you?
Not really, no.
No, well,
not at all, now I come to mention, think about it.
There's a whole genre of movies which just love the idea of gambling, you know, and there are the high points, which are things like The Sting, and then there are sort of the mid... I mean, it's a perfectly flippant popcorn movie, and it's taken a bunch of money, and it's satisfied everybody in that way, but it's in one ear and out the other.
I do remember walking around a hotel in Las Vegas, looking at everyone gambling from about 7:30 in the morning, you know, going down to breakfast and people gambling, and thinking, here's one thing that's not even tempting. Not
Las
even
Vegas
slightly tempting.
Is hell on earth.
The Eye at number 5?
Which is a remake of a Pang Brothers original, which obviously you've seen and obviously you're familiar with, and you know that the Pang Brothers original was more edgy. I mean, it's a perfectly passable remake. The problem with it is it's not frightening. I mean, it's done... You know, it's done sort of with the right intentions, but it's just not scary enough. And it always makes me wonder, well, why don't you just go and see the original with the subtitles? I know people say, if you do them as American versions, they will do better. People have just got to get over the idea that if you want to see an Asian horror movie, you want to see, go and see the, you know, see the wretched thing in its original form.
Maid of Honor at 4.
You know, not funny. And as so many people have now said, Maid of Honor doesn't it's the title doesn't mean anything, and there aren't any gags in it. It just looks like all those old naff old wedding videos stuck together, but with no new gags.
Nim's Island at 3,
which is a disappointment. If you've seen the trailer, you have seen the whole film right up to the very end of the movie. I mean, there's a scene in the trailer which is from the very end of the movie. Jodie Foster is not a great comic actress, or indeed is not a comic actress, and it's a shame because I really wanted to be able to take the kids to see it, but I think it's disappointing, although the trailer looked quite exciting.
Email from Rachel in London on our number 2 movie, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which Rachel says, I saw advertised on sandwich boards on two people walking down the Tottenham Court Road in London.
No.
Novel, at least, compared to buses and phone boxes. I wonder if that's the most interesting form of advertising for films that other people have seen. Anyway, so paying people to walk up and down a street advertising the movie.
I know that
this is the Russell Brand movie, yes?
Yes, exactly. I know there are people that stand on street corners holding up things which say jeans sales, because they're not allowed to put, so they have to say, yeah, so it's a Russell Brand movie, and again, it's more from the, there was a complaint, somebody wrote in and said, oh, Mark just doesn't like this movie because it's produced by Judd Apatow, and he didn't write it and he didn't direct it. And I'm sorry, when a movie comes at you with a poster which says, from the guys who brought you Knocked Up, it's like, I have every right to criticise that, because that's the stable that it's coming from. And in fact, what's interesting is that that stable has effectively managed to churn out variations on the same movie. The best thing you can say about Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which is fairly limp comedy, is that Russell Brand is the funniest thing in it. And he is playing Russell Brand. But don't give me this stuff about you can't blame Juddapatapatapatam, because it's, you know, all the publicity is saying, hey, you know, it's Juddapatapatapatam.
Iron Man's at number 1. Couple of comments here from Martin Jackson. Thought the Good Doctor was a tad churlish in his Iron Man review last week, complaining that in the final reel it turns into Transformers is a bit like complaining that in the final act of an opera the fat lady sings. The film's called Iron Man. Did he not expect some ironclad superhero heroics to climax the film? There was certainly plenty of decent character and situation-driven plot in the rest of the film to make it a cut above most comic book movie adaptations. I'm not usually a big fan of Robert Downey Jr., but I thought he really nailed the character of Tony Stark that I recall from reading the comments as a child.
Okay, so much I have to say about this.
Can you be brief?
I can, yeah. I've got 2 minutes, right?
Well, if you want to do no reviews at all.
Well, I can't do a review in 2, because the first thing we're going to do, believe me, is Speed Racer, and I can't do it in 2 minutes. But I do want to say this, okay, fine. In terms of the bar on these movies was set by Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins, and, you know, people say, oh, Batman Begins, what's so great about it? What's so great about it is that it's a multi-million-dollar art movie. It never sells itself out. It has all that stuff. It has action and spectacle, but it never forgets what it is. It is a proper movie. Now, it's not good enough to simply say, oh, well, you have to do that because that's what happens at the end of them, because what Batman Begins has proven is that you don't have to do it. There are ways round it. I was disappointed when Iron Man did do that. I thought it's a shame, because up until that point it had at least ticked some of the right boxes before collapsing. I still think that against a lot of sort of blockbuster fare, an hour of decent stuff is more than you come to expect. But when you see something like Batman Begins, you think that's how high it could be. The other thing is, I did my Robert Downey Jr. impression and my impression of Gwyneth Paltrow and my impression of Jeff Bridges, right?
Yeah, which, and if I never hear again, that'll
be
fine.
Too soon, fine. If you go onto YouTube, somebody has taken that bit of audio and cut it against the film, with Robert Downey Jr. going and Gwynnie going and Jeff Bridges going, Jeff Bridges! And you know what? I'm absolutely right. And then underneath, there's the comments. Somebody said, this is just ridiculous. I mean, this isn't legitimate criticism at all. But it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. I looked at it and I went, there we go. Not only is it a terrific thing to have done, but it absolutely proves that I was 100% right. And I'm not being mean about Robert Downey Jr. As I said, in the past, he's done some really rubbish stuff. And he has. I'm sorry. There was at least 3 years in which Robert Downey Jr. did nothing but self-indulgent tripe. And don't tell me it's because he couldn't get any other work. That's not an excuse. There are reasons why he couldn't get any other work, for which he has no one to blame but himself. But you know what? In this movie, he's way above par. And I was kind about him. Just because he goes, doesn't mean he isn't any good.
Are we going to start with Speed Racing?
We are. I'm, as you can see, I'm hyped up already.
It's the Wachowski brothers.
It is.
Who's in it?
Well,
Christina Ricci,
Emil Hirsch, Susan Sarandon, but here's the thing about me: it doesn't matter who the human people are. So, Speed Racer, the new movie by the Wachowskis, it's their take on a classic anime series, which I have to say I didn't know. Did you watch Speed Racer? Was it around when?
Nope.
No, me neither. So apparently,
Singing Ringing Tree, that was around.
Yeah, I know. I remember that, and Magic and all that stuff, but I don't remember Speed Racer. Maybe it was only a big thing in America. I'm sure that the emails will now be flooded with people saying no, Speed Racer was on at this certain time, but I hadn't heard of it before. So anyway, it basically basically a pastel shaded alternative world, or possibly it's the future, is a young man called Speed Racer. And as his name would suggest, he is a Speed Racer. That is also his name. He is of the Racer family. And what he wants
to do... Is his first name Speed?
It is. And he feels the need for speed. He feels the need for speed. Where does that come from? Top Gun. Is that Top Gun? I think it is Top Gun.
Is anyway, it Top Gun?
His brother, Rex, wasn't called Speed, but was a famous speed racer. But Rex has now died, or maybe he hasn't, but he has. And so Speed wants to walk in his family footsteps. He wants to get the racer family back up and become the best racing driver in the whole world. But along comes Roger Allen playing this big corporate mogul character with "I am evil" written all over him to attempt to persuade Speed to come away from the family business and sign on the corporate dotted line.
So... I can see you've been giving some serious thought to this thing.
I have. Yes, sir.
Good. That means you understand we're talking about not just your future, but your family's future.
My family means a lot to me.
I know. I can tell. That's why this is so important, because you can help them. All you have to say is yes. It's all I need to hear. And I can make so many things happen for you and your family. You ready for that? You ready to say yes, Speed?
It's that English accent which lets you know he's bad.
But you know, it's interesting. Some people have said that he, in the movie, or in general, looks like Christopher Hitchens. But in fact, the person he's doing in this movie is Tim Curry. He's got Tim Curry's teeth, which is going to bother Tim Curry because presumably he needs them. But he's definitely doing the Tim Curry villainous performance, and very good it is too. Now, here's the interesting thing about this. As I said before, not being familiar with the anime series. The Wachowski stuff beforehand, all the primary colours were black and green. I mean, you think they did the Matrix trilogy, which if you think of the Matrix, you think of the black overcoat, you think of the green background. Before, also, you think of kind of Law of Diminishing Returns in terms of the second one, although I thought the third one, when it ends up with the, you know, him...
Given up by then?
No, I kind of quite like the third one. The second one's a bit mad, although it's got a good chase sequence in the middle of it. The first thing they did before that was Bound, which was this lesbian neo-noir thriller, which was, I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah, actually, do you know, all the family were watching it last night.
They were. They said it's the best lesbian neo-noir thriller we've seen all week, Simon. So, thank you very much.
We were thinking, it's either Ben 10 or a lesbian neo-noir thriller, and as ever
Bound won out. And that's a great movie, because as it being neo-noir, it's all dark now, so that entire palette is basically black and green. In the case of Speed Racer,
hundreds of cars at this school run time, yes, little voices are saying, "Mum, what's a lesbian neo-noir thriller?"
They're all saying, "Mum, what's Ben 10 It's like all the other colours are the dominating thing. This is the pinkest movie you've ever seen. It is pink, it is blue, it is yellow, it is white. It is all retina-scorching. You know Teletubbies, yep, right? Have you ever seen Teletubbies on a big screen? You know, sort of high-def big screen?
No, well, just the usual.
You're like small to... How big's your telly?
Well, it's kind of usual size.
Fine. Well, if you've got like one of these plasmary screens, me neither. But if you see Teletubbies on it, right, it's incredibly bright. You know, this really yellow and really green and really pink, in a way that it's weird. Children's television is almost hallucinogenic in just how strong the colours are. It goes right back to Magic Roundabout. Well, watching Speed Racer, it's like you can almost feel the rods and cones in the back of your eyes going, "If that's enough pink, if I have any more pink, I'm going to cease functioning." The aesthetic kick of it. It's rather like, you know, in a fairground, what's that thing that spins around that makes candy floss?
Is it a candy floss?
A candy
maker?
Floss spin, yeah. Watching the movie is like, it must be, and incidentally, don't do this because obviously it'd be dangerous, putting your head into one of those machines.
Yeah, really, really don't do it
because obviously what would actually happen is it would be very bad. But it's like pink, 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 green, yellow, 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 primary colours rushing at you. It looks like the people who made it have somehow found a way of ingesting space dust into their bloodstream, or getting Bazooka Joe and turning it into some kind of narcotic substance. You know the pink of Bazooka Joe?
Yes.
It's like that. It's that kind
of... Where does that come from? The pink in a Bazooka Joe?
Presumably.
What's it made from?
I've got no idea. It's a, you know...
Do you think it's natural goodness?
I think it probably is, yes. And it's that thing about that in nature there is no food that is actually blue. Well, in nature there is no food that is actually Bazooka Joe pink. But here on Speed Racer, that's the colour palette of the whole film. There is a sort of story, which is there's this kid and his family, and the family is, as we said before, Susan Sarandon. and it's John Goodman, and Emil Hirsch is the main guy, and then you've got a sort of vague love interest played by Christina Ricci. But all of that stuff is irrelevant because it's all done on green screen in much the same way as, for example, Robert Rodriguez made the Spy Kids movies against green screen, or something like Sin City. And in fact, in terms of it bridging the gap between live action and animation, it is every bit as much a kind of an artistic construction as, for example, Sin City is. I mean, it's a thing which blurs the line between computer games and watching films. Have you seen, Wii's, you know, Nintendo Wii?
Yes, yes.
Have you ever seen that game, Super Mario Galaxy? I mean, I before I even start, let me say that what I know about these things wouldn't fill the back of a postage stamp, but have you ever seen Super Mario Galaxy?
No, I've seen lots of other Super Mario stuff. Fine. But is it something that I should be catching
up with? I've seen, you know, my boy plays it, okay, and I can't make head nor tail of it. I mean, but to me, it's like, well, this is what Speed Racer is like. I mean, it's these paralyzing colours and this complete lack of regard for the laws of nature, because these cars don't just drive, they jump, they flip, they fly around, they do all this sort of stuff.
Is it good?
You know what it is? No, here are the things that are good about it.
I just want to know whether I should go and see it or not.
Here are the things that are good about it. Firstly, it's a PG-rated movie. It's interesting that in the American press, they've said that, I mean, Iron Man's done really, really well, and this isn't going to touch Iron Man, but it turns out that in the surveys of people that have been to see it, it says the Warner movie's been tracking best with older women, meaning mums. So that's basically what they're saying is, it's a film that you can take. Now, if I was an 8 or 9 year old boy, I would think that as far as Speed Racer was concerned, you think, blimey, Charlie. And I think there's an IMAX version of it as well, I think, because it is. It's colours and cars and zip and zang boom. Now, there is a story in there which is all about family. It's about you stay with your family, family know best. It's a movie in which when the guys win the race, they don't cover themselves from head to foot in champagne and run off with cool girls into hotels. They drink milk. They have and the milk is so white, you can almost see the whiteness going inside Emil Hirsch's head and making the whole of his body glow pink and yellow and green. So that. The other thing about it is, I mean, it's too long, and there are some storytelling problems that are, actually, funnily enough, I've noticed this in the reviews. One of the things that happens is he's sort of visited by what he thinks is the ghost of his brother. And there are suggestions...
His brother might not have died.
He thinks is the ghost. Do you see how well I constructed that sentence?
Oh, right.
His brother's dead. And
well, you spoilt it now.
Well, maybe I haven't. Maybe I'm actually just, you know, repairing the damage that you're causing. When you see cars pass through each other, and some people are reviewing this and said, well, how has that happened? How can the cars pass through? It's because it's a film.
Because
it's a ghostly car. Uh-huh. That's how it is. But if you're looking for a movie to take your kids to, it is too long. The storytelling is bagging. You may have to say to them at the beginning, look, the first half an hour may not make any sense. And the other thing is, the main plot of it is corporate bad. Corporate take over sports and turn sports bad. Corporate fix all things. Now, I can imagine an awful lot of 8-year-olds going, hey, who? Why? You know, every time the Roger Allam character comes on and says, don't you understand that the way sport runs is like this? They'd be going, well, I don't care. What I really want to see is the red car going really fast and that bit, you know. And there is, the PG certificate says, contains moderate fantasy violence and martial arts sequences. And there is one scene in it in which somebody appears to be being beaten up rather enthusiastically that I thought, oh, that may have pushed them over the limit. That may have pushed them into the realm of 12. But other than that, it's, you know, it's them literally playing to that younger audience. And despite the fact that it's too long, despite the fact the storytelling is very baggy, despite the fact there is, I think, one scene in it that may be inappropriate for younger viewers, despite all of those things, it is something, because your kids will sit there going, well, your male children will sit there going, wow. And I sat there going, on a design level, this is just, you know, this is really extraordinary to look at.
Do you think that's what parents are going to be doing? They're going to be turning to each other saying, do you know what, on a design level, this is great.
It is. I'm not being sniffy. I'm just telling you exactly how it is that I read. I mean, I sat there thinking, what I want to do is I want to run home and get my kids to bunk off school and come and see it. Because, you know, I was thinking, if I was 8 watching this, I'd be going, wow!
Well, so you think... Now, as I've told you before, I had to leave Spiderwick Chronicles because it was scary. I don't want to do that again. I'm fed up with walking out of movies. So there's no Spiderwick moments.
Well, but there is a moment of somebody being toughed up, which is pretty tough.
No, I can probably cope with that.
And also, bear in mind that I loved Spiderwick Chronicles. And I've always had an appetite for that sort of thing. So I can't guarantee you, because it's full, you know, it's full on adrenaline pumping stuff, but it's bubble gum, it's froth, it's none of it's real, none of it's pretending in any way to be real at all. And, you know, and on that level, I was surprisingly thumbs up.
You can watch this extraordinary performance. It's all being live streamed. Natasha on this email: who's the guy through the window throwing balls of paper over his shoulder into the bin? I hope that wasn't Dr. Kermode's contract. That's the departing editor.
Yeah, so that was my contract, yes.
Absolutely. Before he moves on to greater and more exciting projects.
There is nothing greater or more exciting than working with you, Simon.
Is that right?
That's what it says here in my contract.
Martin, on this email, on the commodian subject and whether it should be a word and so on, he says, I do think it's important to define the verb to commode. I commode, you commode, he commodes, we commode, they commode. To commode is, I posit, to interrupt a radio presenter while said presenter is reading out emails from listeners, butting in at inappropriate moments with what he, the interrupterer, which is a great movie, by the way, thinks is a more appropriate point to make, thus wrecking the punchline of said emailer's well-honed gag or upsetting the thread of a well-formed argument.
Yep.
Many people kermode in this fashion, but none quite as trenchantly as the man himself.
All true.
If you read this out and Mark keeps quiet for the whole thing, a bottle of his choice from my wine rack is his. I feel my coat, I think it's coat rotti, is probably safe.
Yeah, I blew that,
in any case,
didn't I?
Mark probably prefers blue nun. Regards as ever.
Yeah, and honestly, and don't make wine snob gags at me, because you know what? I did think that red wine and white wine was what rosé was. But you know, hey.
Enough said.
I can distinguish between 60 different types of tinned lager.
What's next?
What happens in Vegas?
That'll do.
Well, let's just go straight into the clip. It's, you know, Ashton Kutcher and Cameron Diaz, and the, as you know from the title, What Happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and the tagline is Ashton versus Cameron. But,
so, Joy, what brings you to Sin City?
You know, just being spontaneous, cutting loose like everyone else. How about yourself?
Yeah. Me? Oh, I'm here on business. Big business, actually. I'm a pretty important guy in my field.
Really?
No. Actually, I just got fired. So... cheers to that.
I just got dumped, so... salut.
Did I mention that I got fired by my boss slash father?
Did I mention that I threw a surprise birthday party for my fiancé and the surprise was that he dumped me in front of all of our closest friends while they hid in the closet?
Wow. Okay, you win. Excuse me, we're gonna need a whole bottle.
Yeah, you're going to need a lot more than a whole bottle to get you through this. You can just hear the crackling comic tension between them, can't you? So what happens is they get drunk, they get married, and they wake up in the morning, oh, they're married, oh dear, they've got to get rid of the wedding ring. But then they win the jackpot on a fruit machine. It's his, it's her dime, but he puts it in. And there's $3 million at stake, and the only way they can get the $3 million is to stay married, because a judge sentences them to 6 months hard marriage before he will free up the money and give it to the winning person. So now, there's a guy called Don Simpson, who, from one half of Simpson and Bruckheimer, who pretty much invented the idea of high concept movie. The high concept movie is the movie that you can, you know, you can sum up in a sentence, and it is the thing. The classic one is Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito are twins. High concept movie. Okay, in this case, Ashton versus Cameron. That's it. That's the high concept. You know, they go to Vegas. They've got to stay together. Simpson, in his document about what a high concept movie was, did this long thing about, we're in this to make money. We are not in this to make art. We do not need to make art. Occasionally, we may make art by accident in the process of making money, but that's not what we're here for, and that's certainly not what they're here for in terms of what I'm sure they are billing as a modern screwball comedy in the, you know, the mode of the classic screwball comedies of Hollywood. In fact, I think Ashton Kutcher has been on television evoking exactly that, and believe me, you are so far away from being a modern screwball classic, you can't even believe. The funny thing about this was, James King saw it before me, and whenever I see Ashton Kutcher, I think of James King, because they kind of look similar. They've got that kind of terrible dress sense and shaggy hairstyle and, you know, too young and blahzy, blahzy, blahzy. James King is married to Demi Moore.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's debatable. And I thought that James had said to me that he really liked it. So I went in thinking, oh, well, you know, it might be okay. And it's just, it's not very funny at all. It's pretty boring, and there's no chemistry between the two of them. The thing with Ashton Kutcher is he's... Is it Ashton or Aston? Ashton. How do you say
if you just kind of blur it, no one will know to say it fast. No one will notice.
You know, he's a TV kind of personality, and he does his TV kind of personality stuff. And Cameron Diaz is just like a piece of wood. And she doesn't have great comedy. I mean, the best thing she ever did was A Life Less Ordinary with Danny Boyle, which is a very interesting film and very underseen. But there is no tension between the two of them. And the comic riffs don't riff at all. And afterwards, I said to James, what on earth are you talking about that film being any good? He said, I didn't say it was any good. I said, you did. You told me you liked it. He said, no, I didn't say. He said, don't you dare repeat on air that I said that. I didn't say that. What I said
made
was.
Made him go all camp there.
What
just
I said.
For a moment.
What do you mean? Made him go more camp than he is.
Yes.
What I said
Hot
was.
Kettle.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Well, excuse me. Hinge. Bracket.
Oh.
Where's me washboard? He said, no, he'd met Ashton Kutcher, Ashton, whatever that guy's name is, and he was nice, but the film itself, nice, incidentally, but nothing more than that. And the film is just like, I mean, that's it. On the poster, it says him versus her, and that's all it's got going for it. It doesn't have anything else, because they kind of run out of steam so fast that there isn't anywhere else to go. It's just the movie is saying, hey, it's him and it's her. You like him? Fine, here he is. You like her? She was in that thing. Here she is. And all the funny scenes, like the scene with him doing something he shouldn't be doing in the washing up bowl, are in the trailer. Everything's in the trailer, because they have to live together, and each one is trying to make the other one move out. So he's behaving as, you know, pig horribly as he possibly can. So guess what? He takes the toilet seat off. That's a gag that must have taken a huge script meeting. It's a man and a woman living together, and they're really not getting on. What do you think they can have an argument about? You know what? Some people say that women don't like the fact that men leave the toilet seat up. No, really? Did you read that? Yeah, it was in Cosmo.
And love that American camp
thing. The whole thing is like that. It's like they're going to make the gag. And when Cameron Diaz sits on the loo and falls down into it, it's an oral gag, right? You hear it off screen. Ashton finds it necessary to pull out the toilet seat from under his duvet to hold it up to the camera. Wah, wah, wah. You know, we got the gag when we heard the sound of the splashing. It's like there's an idiot Greek chorus going, she fell in the toilet because he took the toilet seat off. And it's your head. I mean, honestly, Speed Racer was a positively intellectually challenging in comparison with that. It's just not funny enough.
Matt in York says, beluga caviar is blue.
Oh, okay.
Ah, you see.
I was obviously wrong.
If only you'd thought of that.
Yeah, I was obviously wrong. And Paul, I'm thrilled to have a listener write in who knows what beluga caviar looks like.
There's a variety of potato that's blue. So much blue. In nature.
Yeah, okay, fine. I was wrong.
Gary in Daytona Beach.
Yeah.
Far away in time. I have a warning for you, Mark, because I want you to be prepared for two cinematic happenings that could destroy your sanity.
Oh, dear.
One, I saw the trailer for the new Adam Sandler movie over here in the States, in which he plays an ex-Mossad agent who moves to New York and becomes a hairdresser.
Crikey, Molly.
It's called You Don't Mess With the Zoan, and it comes out on the 22nd of August in the UK. I thought I'd warn you so you could book a holiday. And hand that one over to James King.
Thanks for that.
Two, Gore Verbinski has signed on to direct the movie adaptation of the video game Bioshock. I realise that in your world, this is the Commodian equivalent of crossing the streams in Ghostbusters.
Yes,
let's
it is.
Let's be very careful.
That would be bad. Can we quickly do Cashback?
Yes.
Because you've seen Cashback as well, right?
Yes.
Feature-length version of a short, which in 2004 was nominated for an Oscar. And apparently the 18-minute short, which was nominated for an Oscar, is actually encapsulated within the film. I didn't see the short. Frankly, I'm amazed that there was 18 minutes of Oscar nominatable in the film, written and directed by Sean Ellis, who I believe is a fashion photographer. Did he come on the show?
No.
Right, okay. Somebody came on the show.
Yes, the female star.
Okay, fine. So the story is this. I was going to play you a clip. We don't have time. I've sat through the movie and I need to have time to say this. It's about this guy, Ben. And, you know, he loses his girlfriend and then he takes a job in a supermarket. And he has this ability. And the ability that he has is to freeze time. And the other ability he has is to talk incessantly about how he has this ability to freeze time in this incredibly aggravating, narcissistic, self-obsessed, boring voiceover kind of way. And at the beginning of the film, it's just, oh, it's going to be a boring story about a boring bloke who's lost his boring girlfriend, his boring job, talking to us about, I'm so, you know, people don't understand me, but I'm an artist. And then it starts getting offensive. He starts saying things like, you know, the thing is that women really want to go out with artists because they think that only artists can look at them properly.
He's
and
not
then,
camp, though.
No, he's not. He's not. Everything I do sounds camp, so I can't, you know, just take the campness out of it. That's what it sounds like. And then it gets into this whole section about how he can freeze time, and when he freezes time, what he does is he takes women's clothes off and he looks at them, and he does, because I'm an artist, you know, because I love the way that women have this power over men, but they don't understand the power that they do, but I'm an artist and I can see this, and women really like this. And there is a scene, and I'm not making this up, because you've seen it, right,
in Sainsbury's,
in which he freezes at Sainsbury's, which appears to be entirely populated by, you know, perfectly put together glamorous models, all of whose clothes are lifted up in a state of disarray that would remind one of a, you know, of the top shelf fare in a museum. And he wanders around. It's the leeriest, creepiest, most misogynistic thing I've seen. I mean, I think it's, you know, up there with most offensive movie of the year. It's like if Andrea Dworkin were around today, she wouldn't have to have arguments anymore about men. She would just go, sorry, have you seen Cashback? QED, evidence, you know, exhibit number one. Thank you very much, Your Honor. And because he's this leery artist who seems to believe that actually appreciating people means effectively sexually molesting them, because that's what he's doing whilst freezing time, people love him because he's sensitive. And I'm, you're watching going, is this a joke? Is this a gag? Right? I mean, quite apart from the fact that it's completely up itself and it's completely full of itself and it's pretentious and it's just, it has an attitude towards women that is so Neanderthal. It's like everyone is a stripper. And you're thinking, this has to be a gag, right? You're not serious about this. You actually want me to think that this guy is lovable. Not that he's some kind of, you know, sex pest who should be... It's creepy, creepy, creepy. And if anyone has ever said to you, you know what? Men, horrible. Say, yeah, you seen Cashback? I think the argument's ended.
Deborah in Kent, Simon the Good Doctor, just dashed in from the school run, switched straight on, says, miss as little of you as possible. I did flinch slightly when, with three small sons in the car, you mentioned lesbians and Ben 10 in the same sentence. Interestingly, my sons paid no attention to the L word, but did immediately pipe up, oh, Ben 10.
Yeah, I told you that's what they say. There we go. You see, it just goes to show.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.